Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment. Shabbat Shalom. If you've never heard of Kazimierz Sakowicz, don't worry, because neither had I until 3 days ago. Under the leadership of Rabbi Savinor, and together with 120 congregants, many in this room, for the past 10 days, I participated on a congregational mission to St. Petersburg, to Moscow, and then about 30 of us to Vilna, to Lithuania. I had never been to Vilna, the capital of Lithuania, where my great-grandparents were born and no doubt many of yours. Vilna, home to the 18th century rabbinic giant, the Vilna Gaon, the once center of all Jewish learning, the Jerusalem of Lithuania, a glorious history that came crashing down in a horrific end at the hands of the Nazis during the Holocaust. On June 24, 1941, just days after the beginning of Operation Barbarossa, the Nazis entered Lithuania. Shortly thereafter, with the arrival of the Einsatzkommando, the German killing brigade, the roundup of Lithuanian Jews began. On July 11th, the first group of Jews were marched into the Ponary Forest to be killed, a prolonged massacre which, by its conclusion about 2 years later, had claimed 100,000 lives, 70,000 of which were Jews. The mass killing ended not due to mercy, but just the opposite. Having calculated the economics of 1.5 bullets for each dead Jew, the Nazis sought a more efficient path towards achieving their murderous goals, the establishment of concentration camps, gas chambers, and crematoria. Standing there in the Ponary Forest earlier this week at the site of the mass graves was to stand at ground zero for the depths to which humanity can sink, as sad and sobering experience as I've had in all my days. What we know about Ponary, we know by way of scraps of testimony from survivors and perpetrators, and none more important than the diary of Kazimierz Sakowicz. Sakowicz was a Polish journalist who lived in the village adjacent to the Ponary Forest, who from that very first evening of July 11th, 1941, chronicled the atrocities, as observed from a hiding place in his attic and by way of testimony of others. Aware of the risks in recording the crimes around him, he hid his notes in glass lemonade bottles and buried them in the ground. We'll never actually know what Sakowicz intended to do with his diaries. He was killed in unclear circumstances in July of 44. His diaries weren't actually discovered until after his death and after the war, and they weren't translated into English until the 1990s. Sakowicz was no saint. I read the diary this week, and there's something jarring about the matter-of-fact manner by which he relates the murderous actions of the Nazis alongside the weather of the day, and how he records his scorn for the Jewish victims. But for me, the take-home of Sakowicz's diary isn't Sakowicz, nor for that matter the Nazi atrocities about which we in this room are well familiar. What I found most disturbing about Sakowicz's chronicle was his characterization of the local Lithuanian population, the accomplices, collaborators, and bystanders to the mass killing. The inhumanity of the Nazis was not new, but the manner by which locals stood by as victims were led to the pits, ignoring their pleas, in some cases doing the shooting themselves, covering them with dirt, stripping them of their clothing, and carrying away their belongings to be traded in the marketplace, that was new. Not one night or two, not 1 month or two, but for nearly 2 years, no record of any moral objection, an entire community complicit in the moral outrage, nobody stepping up to intercede in the face of what must rank as one of the most inhumane chapters of all of human history. Of all of the indicators by which moral behavior can be measured, none is as clear in its breach or fulfillment as the willingness of an individual to put him or herself on the line on behalf of another. It is laudable and praiseworthy, no question, to act in self-defense and care for one's own well-being. So too, a person should always strive to champion and defend the values one holds dear. But as Jews, we go a step further. Moral stature is measured not merely by how we defend our own self-interest, nor for that matter, by way of our support for the ideals we hold in times of comfort. It's our willingness, or as in the case of Lithuania, unwillingness, to intercede on behalf of another, even when, if not especially when, doing so puts our own interests at risk by which we are measured and measure others. We need look no further than this morning's Torah reading and the actions of our people's founder, Abraham, to see this moral standard given expression. As Rabbi Zuckerman spoke of, having been granted a covenant by God in the form of land, progeny, and blessing, Abraham has extended advance warning of God's intentions to destroy the wicked city of Sodom. In a move as bold as it is courageous, Abraham steps up to intercede on behalf of a people that he knows is not presumed worthy of an impassioned defense. Will you sweep away the innocent with the guilty, Abraham argues to God. What if there be 50, 45, 40, 20, 10 righteous people found? Will you, God, still carry out your destruction? The significance of the narrative is not whether Abraham was successful. He wasn't. Nor for our purposes is it today to understand the mystery of divine justice. The significance of the exchange, as noted by the Jewish mystical text of Zohar, is that it's illustrative of Abraham's moral stature and his willingness to go toe-to-toe with God. Unlike Noah, the Zohar explains, who, when informed of God's plan to wipe out the entire human race, went to build an ark to save himself, his family, and a bunch of animals, Abraham beseeches God, risking all, to restrain the divine wrath directed at the inhabitants of Sodom. The circumstances and players of our Torah reading are as different from the aforementioned chapter of Holocaust history as night is today, but the moral muscle group is one and the same. And it's not just this one scene. Throughout the Bible, this is a litmus test, the moral thread by which our biblical narrative is held together. From Cain standing over the blood of Abel, to Joseph's brothers standing by as their brother is in the pit, to Judah placing himself at risk on behalf of Benjamin, to Moses striking down the Egyptian as an Israelite slave is beaten, or more famously, when Moses steps into the breach as the Israelites stand guilty before God for the sin of the golden calf. In each instance and so many others, the moral highs and lows of our people are found in the willingness of an individual to stand up for another. It is this intercessory instinct, as taught by my late teacher, Dr. Yochanan Mufs, which is a mark of a prophet and a hero for our people. As Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of Our Fathers, teaches, in a place where there are no upstanders, strive to be an upstander. And we could, if we so chose, just leave it at that. But for those of you who know what happens next, in the two scenes following the destruction of Sodom, then you know that soon enough our heroic Abraham is cast in an altogether different light. Our stand-up guy, as it turns out, is not always a stand-up guy we would expect him or hope him to be. First, as we read about on Rosh Hashanah, Abraham stands by silently and as Hagar and Ishmael are expelled from his home. Where, we may ask, is our heroic intercessor now? And then more famously, in the following chapter, God calls on Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac, a gut-wrenching request to which Abraham accedes all too willingly. How is it possible that the bold hero who interceded on behalf of Sodom now stands silent when it comes to his own flesh and blood? What has become of Abraham's moral stature? It's a question and conundrum that's perplexing not just to me and you, but to generations of biblical commentators. Why the two Abrahams, the morally heroic and the morally meek? How do we square the circle of our founding father, who over the course of such a short span displays such utterly contradictory character traits? While centuries of rabbis have proposed a variety of answers, seeking to recast, excuse, or mitigate Abraham's behavior, this year I see it differently. This year I would suggest that the point is not in resolving or reconciling the conflict, but it is in the fact of recognizing the conflict itself. I believe the whole point is that we, the reader, are provided over the course of a few chapters of one person, Abraham, offering multiple responses to the call of being an upstander, this central question of biblical morality. Simply put, I think the message of the Torah is that every human being, even the great ones like Abraham, can on any given day be pulled one way or another. None of us live with the weighty inflection points of our biblical forebears, or thank God, the decision-making of those complicit in the genocidal acts of the 20th century. But all of us do live in a world every bit as morally gray as it was on that first day that God created it. And we in this room, just turn on the news, are living through a moral free fall, the likes of which I cannot recall in my lifetime. Every one of us, every day, is faced with a series of decisions, momentous and mundane, that call on us to differentiate right from wrong and choose one path or another. And a certain percentage of those choices will involve a matter concerning not our own well-being, but our willingness to intercede on behalf of others. And then a further subset of those decisions will involve us interceding on behalf of another in a manner that calls on us to risk our own well-being, social, financial, political, and sometimes actual. It's not a traditional read by any stretch, but I believe the Torah intentionally provides us with instances when Abraham got it right, like Sodom, and instances when Abraham got it wrong, like Hagar and Ishmael and the binding of Isaac. Had the Torah done it otherwise, had it given us a one-dimensional Abraham who always got it right, his function as a moral exemplar would cease because it would be unattainable. We need examples of both, because we need to know that for Abraham, as for each one of us, nobody gets it right every time. All of us struggle, but it's this struggle and the knowledge that others have struggled before us that we find strength. We need to keep trying. We need to keep aspiring towards achieving our potential heroic stature, even if on occasion we have failed, even when it is hard, and especially when it seems out of reach. We dare not have the annals of history look back at us as we do of past generations, wondering how was it that good people just stood by silently in the face of evil. That day in Lithuania began with Sakowitz, and it ended with someone named Sugihara. As we returned to the city from Ponary, we stopped briefly at a memorial built in honor of Chiun Sugihara, a diplomat sent by the Japanese government to open a consulate in Lithuania in World War II. Recognizing the dangers faced by Lithuanian Jewry, over a period of just a few months, ignoring the orders of the Japanese Foreign Ministry, Sugihara issued visa after visa, enabling Jews to travel the Trans-Siberian Railway to the port of Vladivostok, where they boarded ships for Kobe, Japan, then to Shanghai, and then eventually, after the war, to safety. Sugihara worked desperately, 20 hours a day, saving as many Jews as he could, until under pressure he himself would be forced to leave. To the very last minute, he issued visas in the lobby as he packed his bags. In fact, according to eyewitnesses, up to and including the moment the train pulled away as he threw blank visas out of the window of the train. A mid-level Japanese diplomat with no prior connection to Jews, some 10,000 visas issued, amounting to over 40,000 descendants today. by way of one man's actions, who after the war, due to his actions, was demoted by the Japanese Foreign Ministry, taking on a series of menial jobs, reduced at one point to selling light bulbs door to door. It would take until 1984, until Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem, would recognize him as a righteous among the nations, to date the only Japanese recipient of the honor. And I stood there that day at the Sugihara Memorial, as I do today, wondering why Sugihara did what he did. Why does anyone do what they do? According to one account, the only explanation Sugihara could muster was, quote, "I acted according to my sense of human justice, out of love for humankind." And while we may begrudge Sugihara for lacking eloquence, perhaps it's a very ordinariness of his response that's instructive and inspiring for us all today. None of us are perfect, and none of us, not even Abraham, get it right all the time. But a common person, you and I, can perform acts of uncommon good. We can all be challenged and elevated beyond what we ourselves think to be capable of, what we think possible. Moral heroism, after all, is reserved not just for heroes. It's there for all of us, inasmuch as we, in our ordinariness, are willing to step up to the calling of the hour. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul. Hallelujah.